Du lyssnar på Microsoft Partnerpodden.
En teknikstrategisk podd för dig i IT-branschen.
Med mig, Adam Palm.
Och mig, Johan Nordberg.
Men hallå och välkomna tillbaka. Johan, idag är du taggad. Du är ju den största GitHub-ambassadören vi har på Microsoft i Sverige.
Ja, idag är det nästan julafton.
Eller hur?
Eller hur? Vi ska hoppa rakt in till vad vi har för gäst idag. Det här är jätteroligt.
Ja, kör.
Yes. Today we are joined by Martin Woodward, who is the Vice President of Developer Relations at GitHub. Did I get that right?
You got that right.
Perfect. Could you please maybe introduce yourself and maybe explain what the heck developer relations actually means?
Yeah, so my name is Martin Woodward, as you say, VP of Developer Relations. So developer relations can mean lots of different things in lots of different companies. At GitHub, our team is the bridge between, we're part of the core product team within GitHub, and we're kind of the bridge between the core product engineering team and then customers. To a large extent, the open source community in particular. So we make sure we do that bridge and make sure when we're building features that we don't, you know, that we make sure the open source community, they were vitally important to GitHub, make sure that's, you know, people are always thinking about those features kind of thing and that functionality. And then also making sure we can connect product people with, you know, people in the real world who have real jobs trying to use GitHub, and we want to make it easier for them. So we do a lot of that. And then we also, you know, run programs and talk about all the awesome stuff and help people learn more about what's coming up with GitHub, what's new and what they can play with.
Yeah.
Located in Belfast?
I am personally located in Belfast, yeah, but the team spread across the world. So I'm lucky in that I'm fairly central, and my team sort of goes from, you know, Australia, India, through Europe, and then across. I'm the only person on my team in Northern Ireland, and then over into, you know, the US, across all coasts of the US. So it's not a huge team, but we're spread across the whole kind of planet just to make sure that the global community that use GitHub have somebody near them that can represent them and kind of, you know, help advocate for their needs with inside of GitHub.
And how long have you been with GitHub?
I've been with GitHub since July 2020 was when I think, well, no, maybe it was just before the pandemic. So probably February 2020 is when I came over to GitHub. Prior to that, I'd spent 10 years at Microsoft, building a lot of the DevOps tools and helping different companies adopt DevOps, and also kind of helping Microsoft do its open, you know, change how it approached open source. So I was, you know, part of a large effort that was doing that. But I was actually the person that originally created Microsoft's GitHub account in 2014. So it ran off my credit card for a little while, and then we moved it over into official systems. And then and was part of, you know, partnered with GitHub since about 2012 actually, because I was part of the team that brought Git into Microsoft as well, and helped the Windows team adopt Git and things like that. And so worked with them for about a long time, and then I was thrilled when in 2020 the opportunity came up to kind of lead their DevRel team, so I was thrilled to come over. It's great, and love it here, if I'm honest. It's you know, it's a very remote first company, and so being in a field in rural Northern Ireland when I was helping run engineering teams and things and product teams in Microsoft, that was always a little bit strange because you were dialed into Teams calls or Skype for Business or Link or whatever it was, you know, across that sort of life cycle. But at GitHub, everybody is kind of remote, and so it's nice. It's kind of, it feels like I found my home. So I do love it here, and I love the community.
Yeah, it feels like it's happened so much around open source and Microsoft over the years. Maybe, yeah. Could you take us a little bit about that journey that Microsoft actually did when it comes to open source?
Yeah, when I so I did a startup, and we were building tools using a lot of open source software in the open source Eclipse IDE, and then doing a lot of cross-platform work, a lot of Java work. And we did that because we were a Microsoft partner, and we figured, hey, this is an area Microsoft are never going to want to get into. You know, this is Microsoft of the mid-2000s kind of thing. You know, this is never where they're going to want to go.
Steve Ballmer era.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is kind of like a safe place, you know, doing Linux tooling for, and we were connecting to a thing called Team Foundation Server. So doing that kind of tooling, they're never going to want to do that. It'll be safe. So we did that, did a startup. It was great. And we were partnered with Microsoft really well. But interestingly, you know, Microsoft were finding all of their customers needed our stuff, which was great for us because we were a 5-person startup, and so they kind of just sold our stuff for us. But then over time, they realized you know, it makes sense for us to be part of the company, so they acquired us and then came over. And during that whole process, I had to get very familiar with Microsoft's kind of open source rules and policies at the time, which were challenging. And quickly realized that if Microsoft were to play, you know, with the open source community and kind of also compete with the whole rest of the world, it needed to change its approach to open source and needed to become part of the open source community rather than separate from it. And so was part of a group, you know, it was initially a fairly small group, but part of a group that kind of changed that, helped change a lot of the policies inside of Microsoft to make it easier for people to contribute to open source. And then also adopted some business strategies that were critically dependent on open source, like Git, for example, which was, you know, GPL V2 licensed code. And so we were one of the first product groups inside of Microsoft to ship that. And so, but building the, with any large company, you can do the thing, but then the trick is to do the thing, but also make it easier for the next person to do that thing who comes up behind you. And so try and fix some of the processes, try and put paths in place so that other people can do that, to make it easy for people to share code with the open source community, to make it easy for Microsoft to contribute back. And now they're one of the, if not the largest contributor to open source in the world. And so, you know, by changing that, it really helped. And it also adjusted Microsoft's management's mindset to open source. You know, it was more of a, hey, how can we partner together rather than try and compete, which I think is the defining kind of, you know, what people's memory is from the Ballmer era is kind of the compete with. Once they had Azure, though, they didn't need to compete with Linux anymore. You know, they can work with Linux. And so that change actually started within the Ballmer era, but obviously once Satya Nadella came on board, it allowed a lot of people to think differently about things, and the company pivoted quite heavily. So yeah, I was very lucky in the time I joined Microsoft as an open source person. I was able to do what I do, and then the company kind of came towards me. And then so obviously when the GitHub investment happened, and then Microsoft decided to bring GitHub on board, that was great news for me as well, because it again meant I was able to go and help that community. So that was great fun.
Yeah, it almost felt a little bit when Microsoft acquired GitHub that people were a bit worried, but over time, I mean, the way it looks now, it seems like it's a very, very, very good fit for both GitHub and Microsoft.
I agree. And I think when people were worried, it was because they were thinking of an older Microsoft, a previous generation of the company. And so they hadn't really been keeping up to speed with where the new Microsoft was. Like if Microsoft had acquired GitHub, well, you know, they couldn't have acquired GitHub, but I used to look after Coplex, for example. Like Coplex was the thing that I looked after and then shut down, which was Microsoft's old open source hosting thing. Like in the old days, it would have been to compete, but actually bring that community in, you know, make sure that they've got the investment. And then also we see huge innovation, like things like GitHub Copilot, which was the first kind of Gen AI based product out there in market. And now it seems like every team in Microsoft has a Copilot. So yeah, it's been interesting to see how that well, I think people were worried that GitHub was going to be more Microsoft-y. What's actually happened is Microsoft's become more GitHub-y, and so that's awesome. But that change had started long before the acquisition started.
And I think something you said is very interesting, and it's something I hear a lot. You know, you speak to certain partners and customers, and they always like to articulate that, oh, no, we're a Linux company, or we only know Linux. And like, you'd be amazed how much Linux there are in Azure. It's primary Linux that runs on Azure. Is
yeah. Yes, but what's also interesting, because of that, it requires, like, if Microsoft can make Linux 0.03% faster, that saves them billions of dollars in Azure running costs, which they can then pass on to their customers, so they can then justify those investments. And so that was kind of the mindset shift, was to be able to come in and think, okay, well, if we invest this to make this open source product faster, then, you know, we can get the benefits. And it just helps you have long-term sustainability of engineering teams focusing on products that happen to be open source. And open source is not a zero-sum game. You know, you can contribute to open source for your own needs and still be benefiting the whole community. And that's the change that happened, I think.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing is also you said, you know, the GitHub Copilot is the longest running AI.
It's longer than ChatGPT, interestingly enough.
That we have, but you know, for 99% of people, Copilot is M365 Copilot. Talk a bit about, you know, the GitHub and Copilot, and where did that start, and the whole Codex initiative.
Originally we got our hands on a very early version of the OpenAI models. Codex was the model, which was, I think it was based on GPT-2, if I remember rightly, but a different version. Anyway, we got our hands on it and just ran some experiments to see how good it was at writing code. I was insanely skeptical.
Is this like 2016, 17?
No, this is a little bit later. This is, I don't know the exact date if I want to. It feels like it was ages ago, but it probably wasn't that long ago, you know, because it's I'd need to go check. Yeah, exactly. So it was very soon before we shipped a product. Like, it wasn't that soon, you know. So we got our hands on the model, had a play, and wrote a paper actually about using LLMs to solve, you know, coding problems. And we were seeing a ridiculously high, way of, you know, it was successful. We've got more refined over time, actually, how we measure success. Nowadays, we measure code acceptance rate. So when you accept a suggestion from Copilot, that's the primary measure of, are we better or worse than we were before? Because, you know, you need to do DevOps with everything. And so doing, like, that's how we measure if the changes we're making are making it better or worse, is by acceptance rate. There is a paper out there that actually, and I can give you some links, which shows you that there is a direct correlation between code acceptance and perceived productivity by the end user. And then there's another paper which shows this direct correlation between perceived productivity and real productivity. So that's why with everything when you're doing OKRs, when you're doing measurements, when you're doing anything kind of DevOpsy, you're always looking for these leading edge indicators, which will give you the business benefits that you want. The business benefit we want is increased productivity for developers. So we see those acceptance rates. So anyway, we saw ridiculously good performance from these early versions. And so we then set about turning that into a product, which we call Copilot, which was one of the early code names, and had to fight to kind of make it stick. So I'm quite glad it's good, because everybody now says what a great name that is, you know, because it is your Copilot. You're not, you know, it's not in control, you are, kind of thing. It kind of establishes that relationship really well. But yeah, it could have been. Could have been a number of names, so I'm glad we stuck with that one. And then we brought it in, tested it, worked great. We then shipped an early version of Autocomplete very, very quickly with a small team. And again, I'm super skeptical, thinking, is this really going to work? You know, are we really going to use this? Because I'm a developer. AI felt like yet another kind of fad, and, you know, everybody was getting on board. But actually, it was stunningly good. So good that from that first version, I'm like, now I'm not switching this off ever. This helps me be too productive. You know, I'm so productive with this added. I don't want to ever switch this off. And then we've just iterated that product over time, got it better and better. As new models have come along, we actually upgrade the model that Copilot users are talking to. And we introduced chat functionality that went GA in December last year. So you can talk to, you know, your AI coding assistant as well as that we do autocomplete. And we see, you know, right now we're seeing like, the last study, there was a study that we did with that was just autocomplete. And there we saw kind of 55% faster at coding and, 15% kind of higher code quality. But then there was a recent study that just finished with Accenture, because Accenture have rolled Copilot out to a ton of their people. And Accenture is seeing that 94% of their developers are reporting that they are staying in the flow more because of this tool. And actually we see like 50% more builds happening and 84% more successful builds happening because of once teams have Copilot installed. And that's the key that I think people need to see. That GitHub Copilot is about productivity, is about improving the iteration time of a developer, you know, reducing that iteration time down. It can't tell you what to do. It can't solve customer problems. Like, you're a developer, you have to figure that out. What it can do is allow you as a developer to iterate a lot more quickly and get solutions into market a lot more quickly. So then you can test if you've made things better or worse, and you can do that. And that faster iteration time is also directly correlated to developer happiness. Yeah. And that's our key, that we want to make developers happier. We want to improve the developer experience. We want to make people more productive. And that and Copilot is really helping us do that. It's been fabulous.
And I think that's so important to articulate because I had the opportunity to speak to graduates that were doing a sort of a trainee program at a big global consult house, L company, and a lot of them were developers. And so I spoke about, you know, AI and generative AI models in particular and stuff like that. And a lot of the participants came up to me afterwards and asked me, like, do you think being a junior developer 2024, 2023 is that a bad choice for a career because of everything that's happened right now? And I think it's so important to understand that developers are still needed and will be needed. This is a tool making them better or more efficient. It's not replacing them by any sense of the imagination, basically.
Yeah, it's like a mainframe developer worrying that, you know, all this client server stuff is going to get rid of development kind of thing. No, it's just rapidly going to increase the productivity of developers. Capitalism doesn't work in that we get to do less work, you know. People want to solve these problems quicker, want to get them into market quicker. So no, I think the key when I'm talking to graduates, first thing is we give Copilot for free to students and teachers, because just like when the pocket calculator came in and that kind of changed how you approached, you know, mathematics, with AI coding, that changes how you want to approach things. And so we give it to the teachers and we give it to university students for free as part of the GitHub student pack, so that they can figure out when they want to use these tools and when they don't want to use these tools. It's important that they learn. And then when I'm talking to them as well, it kind of reduces the, you need this programming language and that programming language and some of those sorts of things. I think that, you know, the actual languages you've got experience with might reduce in kind of importance. But to be honest, in most of the technical interviews today, once you get a certain level, they're not about the languages you know anyway, because they assume that people can flip languages quite easily anyway. It's more about programmatic thinking. It's about solving the customer's problems with technology and being customer focused, which is what at least the past 10 years, is to get a lot more customer focused and a lot more targeted on solving help problems, you know, delivering value to end users. Yeah. And as long as people focus on that, the exact programming language they use is probably less important, because Copilot can kind of help there. What's fascinating as well is just how good some of the new models are at non-English human languages. Like, these large language models are great at translating between, say, GPT-4 is amazing at translating between human language and coding languages, you know, and you can tell it which of those two you want. So if you want to talk in Swedish to Copilot, it will respond to you in Swedish, which is pretty amazing. And for people in, you know, sort of growing economies, being able to take a large code base, which they're delivering into often in English, and the comments are often in English, and say, hey, explain this code to me, please. What does this code do in my language? That's going to be massive in terms of bringing a whole new generation of people into engineering. So, yeah, I'm very excited about what's going to happen, I think.
And I also say, regarding your question, Adam, that it's been so many times during my career that something has come along that made my work different and faster. But it didn't mean that I worked less. It just meant that I shipped more during the same time. So, like a stupid example, in the beginning of my career, if you wanted a calendar picker, you had to write a calendar picker. Then open source came along and you never wrote a calendar picker. And now AI came along and there's a lot of things that I don't do anymore, but I still need to understand that I need them and how to use them. I just don't write them every single line of code myself anymore. And I think that, like, Copilot is so much in the sense that it's different, but it won't really change my job that much. It changed how I do it, but not that I do it.
Yeah, not what you do. And it also, with those changes, the quality has improved.
Yeah.
Like, if you think of the really, like, a terrible calendar UI we used to give people, it was basically like a free text field with terrible validation, and like it could barely determine, you know, the year 2000, for example. And now we've got these amazing calendar pickers that are wonderful because of open source.
Yeah.
And then with a thing like Copilot, you say, hey, I need a calendar picker. It sort of helps you choose which open source library you might want to use for that particular language and bring those in and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's just improves productivity is the goal.
Yeah. Speaking about Copilot, recently in the last week or so, I think, something called GitHub Copilot Enterprise was released.
Yeah.
How is that different from the Copilot that we've known about so far?
Yeah, so currently everything you've been doing with GitHub Copilot has been in the IDE. So whether that's Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code, IntelliJ, you know, NeoVim, all those sorts of places, it's been where you're coding. And that's important that we get the stuff there. But actually, when we look at developer time, it depends on the team. You'd be lucky if you spend more than 25% of your day actually coding, and the rest of the time you're outside of the development environment doing other stuff, whether that's reviewing pull requests or, you know, doing code reviews kind of thing, or if that's logging issues, or if that's, God forbid, talking to customers, you know. And so we want to actually improve the productivity across all of the end-to-end developer lifecycle. So with Copilot Enterprise, we've added, the simplest way is like we've added the Copilot chat box to github.com. So if you go in there now, you can start asking questions from github.com. You can go into a pull request and you can say, what is it? I think it's like 40-odd% of pull requests don't have a description. And a pull request is that point of code review, which is terrible. And so you can actually now come in and say, hey, Copilot, give me a summary of this pull request. And it will put a summary in of what that code actually does, not what the developer thought it did, but what it actually does.
Yeah, give me a summary. And it's really detailed.
And it's really detailed with links to the files.
To the actual numbers in the files as well.
Yeah. This week as we're speaking, we've changed that drop-down. So there's two options. There's one where you can get an outline, which is a more summary version, and then one which is a more detailed version. So, but yes, it's incredibly detailed, but it's actually what it does. And then we've also, through things like GitHub Advanced Security, we're powering those with Copilot now. So previously with GitHub Advanced Security, you could say, you could scan for security issues, you know, in your code base, get notifications of what the security issues were, along with a why is this a problem kind of thing, you know, a summary. And that's what existed within GitHub Advanced Security. What we've added for GitHub Advanced Security people is the ability for Copilot to actually come in and say, and here's a suggested fix. Because it turns out we've got an awful lot of good prompt data now from this is the defect we've found, this is how these things are usually fixed, this is what the problem is. Feed those all into the large language model prompts, and come back with Copilot with a suggested fix. And so, yeah, that's another thing. Then the area that's actually really, I think, most impactful, but people don't really see it yet, is because it only shipped, you know, as we're speaking, kind of this last week, past couple of weeks, around the Copilot Enterprise side, is the ability to search with your code's context in the prompt, in the query, you can think of it as. So when you're typing in the IDE, when you're doing chat in the IDE, it takes context of based on where you are. You know, are you in a C# file? Are you in a TypeScript file? Are you in a Python file? What files do you have open around it? What are the unit tests doing that point to this code? You know, what's the debugger done recently? Have you had an error recently when you've been debugging or when you've been running the console? It can take that context and use that to inform the prompt that Copilot builds when it sends the request over to the server, which is cool, but you've all got the whole knowledge base that's locked up in your code that exists. And with Copilot on the server, you can now kind of get access to that as well and start unlocking the knowledge that's there. So a demo I quite often do is I'll ask Copilot without any context, hey, how do I create a short URL? And it'll tell me, you know, use Bitly, use tiny URL. It'll give me some Python code or whatever to go do it. And we're like, OK, cool. Then I give it the context of GitHub's internal knowledge base, which is, you know, a private repo, which is our kind of intranet, if you like. But it's a bunch of markdown files. And I can say, hey, using this, using our internal intranet now, create me a short URL. How would I create a short URL? And the answer it gets back is instantly different. It says, at GitHub, use this chatops command, and which is .shorten, and then it even says, you know, gives you the URL and gives you a guess of what the URL of the thing should be. Because it can now see that the coding standards at GitHub, the operating procedures at GitHub, are for short URLs. You know, when you're doing URL redirection, we have a thing called GHIO, which is a bit like Microsoft's aka.ms service. You know, we have the same sort of thing here. Use that. Here's the chatops command to use it. And boom, done. And so imagine that now extended to all of your coding and all of your questions. If you're a DRI and you are like debugging a live site issue, being able to explain what code does that you haven't downloaded yet onto your local machine, figure out who the expert is on that code, figure out how we deploy these things, how these are done in production, and kind of get summarizations of all of that massive amount of knowledge into something that's humanly readable in your human language, whatever your preferred language is. That's massive.
Yeah.
And that's only going to grow. And then there's, you know, in the future, there's, we can talk about what's coming up in the future for it in a bit, but yeah, it's going to be huge to people. So
yeah, yeah,
that's Copilot Enterprise.
I often get the question like around what you said, that what, when I use Copilot chat in the IDE, what does Copilot actually know about my repo, for instance? And obviously it does not. But with Enterprise now in at github.com, that you actually can index your repo and then chat with the whole repo. I mean, imagine getting like a fresh at a new company and looking at the code base for the first time, and you're giving your first issue to solve. Just like, okay, where do I... how do we handle authentication? Where does this feature, where is that implemented? What does this code do? And having that there, that's freaking cool.
It is, and it gives you the receipts. Yes. It gives you links back to where it finds that code too. And then that allows you then to discover things and dig more and so on. So yeah, that's what I really like about it, is that it gives you the references.
And I also like that in a pull request, that you can, for a particular line, for instance, you can press a little Copilot icon and say, like, explain this to me.
Yeah, what does this do, really? What does this regex mean?
Exactly.
You know, So it's so that's the Copilot Enterprise stuff that's coming out for everybody that's available now. To do it, you have to have a GitHub organization that's on the like Copilot Enterprise plan. So, you know, that's the major difference, is Copilot for Business, you know, in the IDE, that can work with any version control system. It can work with anything. Whereas with Copilot Enterprise, you get more value the more of your code actually is in the GitHub side as well. So that's important to remember.
Yeah, and it's also recently become much easier to buy the regular GitHub Copilot using Azure, like an Azure, Azure subscription or a Mac agreement, for instance. So that's good to know as well, I think.
Yeah, you can attach your GitHub Enterprises to an Azure subscription, and if that's how you prefer to pay for things, then that works as well. So yeah, or you can still give us a credit card. We take credit cards still. That's what's quite nice about being at GitHub. I always remember credit cards at Microsoft were a nightmare, so I'm quite pleased we have both options now.
Yeah.
I'd like to just touch on a thing that you said earlier in regards to you said that teachers and students, there's a certain subscription for them.
Yeah.
How important do you think to have this sort of tools available when you do your education? Because I think it's super important. I think in Sweden we do seem to have sort of a problem, because I meet a lot of people that, you know, newly graduated, and they are quite new to, let's say, cloud computing, for example. They haven't used public cloud or cloud computing or those type of frameworks, and which for me is a bit surprising, because I think, you know, that's such a big part of, you know, the delivery of applications the company uses today. So should also be a part of the education. So how important do you think it is to get the hands-on experience, and quite early in your education as well?
Yeah.
And another thing, do you think it can interfere with the actual education?
Yeah, well, let's cover both of that. So in terms of how important is it, you know, I think, you know, a lot of historically, there's, you know, some people in the computer science kind of academia are in it because it's interesting, and, you know, they get very caught into the solving interesting problems and doing the research side, and kind of lose sight of what many of their graduates, what many of their students are coming to do, is to learn about this technology so they can directly apply it into industry. So the most forward-thinking programs and the most forward-thinking professors around computer science are understanding that their best and brightest students aren't just interested in careers in research, but are also interested in careers in the industry, and are shaping their courses so that it equips both. You know, there's a lot of fundamental computer science research still needed to be done. Copilot comes out of fundamental computer science research that's been done, and actually was led by a former professor from University of Oxford, was the original kind of person, you know, one of the founding people of that original team. So, but they also need to equip people to go out into industry. And part of that is using tools that industry expects you to use, understanding how to work with the open source community, understanding how to work with the public clouds. And so I think it's vitally important for, you know, new graduates to have those knowledge. Also understanding how to work in teams. Like everyone who's done sort of computer science, so I didn't do a degree in computer science, actually. I did a degree in physics with some industrial experience in computers. But the you need to learn how to work in a team is very vitally important. And everyone has those experiences of the dreaded team projects, you know, because you've always got like two or three people that kind of pull the weight of the whole kind of six group team that goes through. But again, that's part of learning how things work and learning not to let people down and all that sort of side. So yes, that's why we actually give a lot of this tooling away for free to students. And then we've got people like, leading institutions like Harvard. They do their CS50 class. It's all publicly available to anybody in the world. They can go take it. They can go study it. And that is actually, that's even more advanced, because not only is he using tools and technologies like Copilot and, you know, and talking to public clouds and things, it's also hosting the entire developer workstation in what's called a code space. So that's a containerized dev environment on GitHub. And it uses that extensively so that students can come in with basically an iPad or a Chromebook or something and still get access to a full development environment that's set up exactly how they want it. And so we see these leading industries, and not just necessarily at the leading institutions, but the leading professors, regardless of what institution that they're in, really taking advantage of these new technologies and using it to teach to students. But as part of that, you need to know when to switch it off. So for example, if you're doing an exam in Python programming, that is not the time to have Copilot enabled, usually, unless they tell you you're allowed to have it on. Just as if there are times when you're doing a mathematic exam where you're allowed the pocket calculator and times when you're not. Yeah. As you're learning as well, you know, there are times where Copilot can be too good and just give you the answer. And so my son is actually a student right now doing computer science. This is very relevant to me. You know, you learn when to switch that off so that you learn how to build those skills. And it's important that you do that so that you are, you know, you learn how to, when this is going to be, what am I doing this for? Am I trying to crank out code right now? Or am I trying to, you know, learn something about for loops or whatever, that by making myself go through this process, my brain will grok and will understand better. So, yep. Yeah. And that's why we help people get access to the tools. Yeah. And don't just give the tools, like, don't just make it so that only the people who go to the richest universities in the richest countries can afford these tools. Like, we need to give these tools to everybody so that everybody across the world can get access to these and build like the best people in the world, you know?
Yeah. I actually talked to one university, and they were like, what's the catch? Why is it free?
So, yeah.
But
it's free because we want people to come into it's supply and demand as well.
Yeah.
Like, we want people to arrive in industry with knowledge of all these skills and all these tools so that when they land in their next job, they can go, oh, yeah, you're using GitHub. Great. Yeah, you're using Copilot. Brilliant. Yeah. Or, wait, you're not using Copilot? Sorry, you need to go buy Copilot before I will work here.
Yeah, so, and I think that if we can even call that a catch, but the only catch is that you don't get human support with a free plan. That's basically the only thing that you doesn't get. And that's logical. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're starting to run out of time a little bit, but I'm wondering, can you share something about what's coming next on GitHub or in Copilot?
Yeah. So
I promise I won't tell anyone.
So we're already kind of looking at, you know, you see us looking more and more into kind of customization, into personalization, making these results better for you. So initially, the first versions of the models, they're giving you answers based on, you know, what it thinks in the model is the most likely word to come next after typing something. We want to customize more and more of that to you. So you've seen in the IDE, we, you know, increased in the number of links. So initially it was just the code you had open. Now it knows a lot more about your developer context based on like what's in your debug environment, what's in your console window, that sort of thing. You've seen personalization with GitHub Enterprise expanding the code. So it's based on like the suggestions are based on the code that you've got in your repo, you know, the coding standards that you've got, that sort of thing. So we're just going to extend that more and more and make the results more personalized towards you, is the first approach. So you've seen us doing kind of one way, which is... it's based on a model called RAG, so Retrieval Augmented Generation, where we're doing a search in the back end, firing the results into the prompt with a model that actually builds the prompt, and then sending that to the prompt and then getting the results back. That's how GitHub Enterprise is working today. We are looking at the potential of doing fine-tuning. We've actually tried fine-tuning a model for the Microsoft Office team, and AMD were another company that we've talked about where we've tried this out. And that gave a higher code acceptance rates for those particular teams. Now, I actually have a spicy take on fine-tuning. I think that if you need to fine-tune the model and it improves your code, your acceptance rates significantly, like we're seeing, you know, 20% acceptance rate improvements by fine-tuning it for these two people, that's because your code is hard to maintain. If you were to hire a developer off the street and bring them into your team, they would have a big learning curve before they could start coding, because you can think of what the model knows as a rough proxy of what the internet knows, you know? And so if you're like using Verilog, which is a company a lot of people use for embedded programming, which is what AMD happen to use, like there aren't a lot of Verilog developers, so you're going to need to like ramp them up on that. If you're in the Office team at Microsoft, they have a lot of you know, macros in C and things and C++, and so their version of how they code is actually very different to like a regular C++ developer that, again, you've got a bunch of onboarding. But if it improves acceptance rates, if it makes people more productive, we're definitely going to do that for the, because that's huge value for the companies that need it. I just hope it's not every company. I strongly think it won't be. And then the other area that we're investing heavily in is around, we announced this at Universe last year, but we're sort of starting to see some of it now, is around making Copilot. You know, GitHub is a hub. GitHub is a platform. And so making GitHub Copilot extensible and being able to kind of get in there and add your partner extensions. So say if you're DataStax or LaunchDarkly, and you're in some code and you want to say, hey, is this feature flag enabled in production? Then being able to go out to LaunchDarkly, ask that question, bring that in, and bring that in as part of the prompt data, and share that with people. So that's, again, an area where it's, you know, it's kind of early, very early days at the minute, kind of defining all that stuff. But I would hope to see more of that later on in the year as well.
Yeah. Great. Do you think we ever come to a point where, like, if I create a pull request that I can assign Copilot as a reviewer? Are we there soon?
A reviewer? So there's a couple of things that's really interesting.
A little bit like advanced security code scanning, that not only security issues, but actually, are my code good? Can you, like more like a human would for the whole pull request, not just security?
Yeah, so... yes, we're like looking at things like that. What's really interesting is how we make sure we keep the developer in control. Yeah. So what we don't want to do is build an experience where you are, where you're responding to stuff from the machine. We want the machine to be doing things for you, if that makes
sense. Yeah, but I was kind of thinking like, say we're a team. I create a pull request and I first get Copilot to look at that.
Yeah, to give you a review.
Before I send it to you for review and approval. So maybe some machine that I don't have to be embarrassed about can discover my mistakes before I show it to my colleague or boss or whatever.
So that's definitely something that's interesting to the team. I think what we'll also see is the ability to kind of iterate with Copilot in a pull request as well. So being able to kind of say, hey, this bit over here, like, make a first pass at this for me, and then I can come in and edit it and fix it and kind of, you know, some of that side as well. So yes, but also I think there's a lot more within that kind of pull request workflow where Copilot could help. But again, that's back into the way distant future, that sort of thing. So yeah, but yeah, we're definitely looking at that.
Yeah.
Cool. You were telling us before we started that you were off to the airport after this, going to Seattle, was it right?
Yeah, off to Seattle. I haven't been for a while, so it's nice to go back to the mothership from where I used to have to go back. I used to go to Seattle a lot when I worked at Microsoft. Now it's San Francisco and things at GitHub. So yeah, it's Microsoft's MVP Summit is this week as we're recording. And so going to head out and catch up with the Microsoft MVPs and chat about all this stuff and what's coming up in the future, all that sort of thing.
And collect some stickers.
I'm taking some stickers. Yeah. I've got a lot of stickers to give out because GitHub's the funniest company. So everywhere, you talk about, you'd order stickers in 100, 200 kind of thing. At GitHub, I order stickers by the kilogram. So I'm taking 2.5 kilograms of stickers with me to the MVP Summit. So should be good.
Great.
Well, great stuff. And, we're so happy, Martin, that you could join us today.
Thank you for having me.
Super privileged to have you on the podcast. So a big thank you to you and to everyone that have listened. I hope you have a nice day or a nice week, and see you soon.
Du har lyssnat på Microsoft Partnerpodden, en podd om Microsoft Sverige med mig, Adam Palm,
och mig, Johan Nordberg. Som vanligt hittar du länkar och resurser på aka.ms/partnerpodden.
Maila oss gärna på partnerpodden@microsoft.com.